I'm going to talk today about some sort of an attempt to organize galaxies or simplify galaxies in a way to, I hope, lead to some understanding of galactic structure. So the idea is basically we're going to see if, in fact, there are any underlying simplifications we can put together for describing galactic structure that we can then take advantage to build, hopefully, a more intuitive picture of what's going on with galaxies. Now, the basic question is then, are the rules simple or complicated? There's, of course, no guarantee that the rules describing how a galaxy forms and how its structure comes about, and by structure I mean gross terms, size, velocity, dispersion, luminosity, how those come to be. We would like, of course, for the rules to be simple and elegant, but in fact, they could be very messy. And as we look more and more towards simulations for uncovering what those rules are, the rules seem to be getting more and more complicated. And so, is it really in fact the case that you need to understand a lot of different steps to get to a prediction of what type of galaxy you're actually going to see? Or are we sort of heading down the wrong road by looking into all these processes, which must happen, but perhaps are not critical in really in setting up the basic properties of a galaxy? Of course, you know, we focus on the dark matter, but it's really the baryons that do the things that end up being what we observe. And so this is, in fact, the cause for the difficulty we've had, is that the baryon physics is complicated. So what do the baryons do? And there are many processes that contribute to what baryons do. And this is, of course, why we're sort of in such a quandary when we try to understand and predict what a galaxy looks like. And so if you think you need to understand all of these in perfect detail to understand how a galaxy comes about, then, you know, good luck, and I'll be moving on to a different field, because we're not going to understand all of these in great detail before I'm done. So let's try to see if we can make progress by simplifying things. So really, we'd like to know what fraction of the baryons form stars, and then how do those baryons settle into the halo? And of course, that then does not mean a sequential one, step one and step two, but these are sort of two basic questions we'd like to understand. What fraction baryons form stars, and how are those baryons distributed in the halo? And that, if we could understand that in gross terms, we might get some intuitive understanding of what galaxies are doing. So let's go back and see what lessons we've learned from one of the great successes of astrophysics, understanding stars, and whether we can take any of those successes and move the intuition we get from those successes over to galaxies. And of course, the linchpin of stellar structure is the HR diagram, where you see that stars don't populate evenly all of the parameter space that they could populate, but in fact lie in specific locations. And if we just consider the main sequence, what we have is a one-dimensional sequence of equilibrium positions into which a star can settle. And of course, you don't need to understand stellar structure or anything yet to just appreciate from this diagram that there must be a simple one-dimensional description of these stars, one parameter that drives the location of a star along the main sequence. So simply from the observation that in this observing space, two parameters, you form this one-dimensional sequence, tells you that the equilibrium that stars find must be described by one parameter. You just slide that star somewhere along there. And right there, you've gained a lot, because you know that there's an answer. So you sort of have at least an empirical proof that somewhere there must be some order that you can try to uncover. So This is what we're going to try to do with galaxies, see if we can identify some set of equilibria that lead us to an understanding of how many parameters might drive the principal properties of galaxies. And of course, an important point here is that this the problem of structure here is separated from that of formation. So you don't really even need to know how the stars form to get onto this. As long as you know that there's such a sequence, then you can just look at the equilibria. And of course, for stars, we understand stellar structure much better than we understand star formation. And so you don't need to understand everything to understand where a star lies on here. You, just by understanding stellar structure, you can identify this locus of equilibria. In galaxies, we're sort of trying to have everything at the same time. We're trying to understand formation and structure all at the same time, and that's what makes the problem so complicated. So, are there any analogs to this for galaxies? That's going to be the question. And of course, there are some hints of analogs. For spiral galaxies, there's the Tully-Fisher relationship. So you plot, you know, the circular velocity versus the luminosity. And in some ways, that's sort of comparable to what you do with stars. And in fact, you see a sequence here. This is from the original Tully-Fisher paper. This is from much more modern data, where there are many more galaxies. And so you have a sequence for spiral galaxies, for disk galaxies, that sort of places spirals on this apparently one-dimensional sequence here. What do we have for elliptical galaxies? Well, for elliptical galaxies, we have what's called the fundamental plane, where we plot the half-light radius along this axis, actually log of the half-light radius. And then on this axis, we plot a log of the velocity dispersion plus a measure of the mean surface brightness within the half-light radius. Okay, so here we actually have a three-space instead of just a two-space, and with the proper rotation in that three-space, all those galaxies end up lining up in such a way that you see a line in this plot, in this projection, which means that these galaxies are then distributed in a plane. So in this three-space, you plop down elliptical galaxies, they lie on a plane, you rotate that appropriately, and you see that edge on, that's the fundamental plane. Now, there are various problems with trying to use the fundamental plane and understand it. First, it has these odd coefficients here, which will be hard to try to intuitively understand. Why, you know, why is it 1.24 and why is it 0.821? It's going to be hard for a theory to come up with that. That's certainly one problem. The other problem is that, in fact, the fundamental plane doesn't extend to all galaxies. If you try to put low luminosity ellipticals on this, it fails. Okay? So part of the problem is that these empirical relationships are not intuitively clear why they exist. And second is that they exist for separate kinds of galaxies. So you have one scaling relationship for spirals, you have another scaling relationship for ellipticals, dwarf ellipticals don't really fall on this. And so it's hard to get everything together into one coherent picture. And there has been an attempt to put it all into one coherent picture. This was a paper in 97 by Burstein et al., where they've tried to, so this is a slight reformulation of fundamental plane in what they called kappa space, where they took those same observables and built other combinations. But in essence, this would be the edge-on view of a plane in that space. And you can see that, in fact, it doesn't really look like a very good fit. Some objects are even off the plane, others are twisted around, and so forth. And so what they ended up concluding is that, in fact, they had a continuum of fundamental planes, so sort of a fundamental volume, I guess, and that they just couldn't really, you know, disentangle this, and so they just sort of left it as, you know, we're close and we sort of see hints of some structure, but it's hard to really break it down into one overriding description of galactic systems. So perhaps there really isn't any. So where are we? All right. So there appear to be some basic rules of galactic structure, at least for certain galaxy types. There's some pretty tight scaling relationships. Tully-Fisher for spirals works very well. Fundamental plane for ellipticals works very well. But there's unification is lacking, and it may or may not be possible to do that unification. And it's difficult to merge those with the physical model because they're very empirical. So they have these odd coefficients which are just fit to make the scatter the least possible. But it wasn't really described from first principles. So let's go back and start with the basics here. So all of these presumably arise from the virial theorem. They're all results of the virial theorem. We're seeing virialized systems. Certainly in the inner parts of galaxies, the systems are virialized. So we can start with the tensor virial theorem and see where we go. All right, so the first term here just describes the bulk, the kinetic energy and the bulk motions of a galaxy. So if you take a disk galaxy that's rotating, this is the term that has the rotation velocity in it. So it's kinetic energy in the bulk of the stars. So basically, if you knew what the individual stars were doing, you would just sum up their mv squares, and you would get the contribution to the tensor virial theorem from those stars. I'm going to say that the sum is going to be some constant A0, which is to be defined, times some characteristic velocity of the system. In a disk galaxy, that would just be the circular velocity. Okay, so that has to be true because I haven't told you what A0 is yet. All right. We move to the second term. This is the pressure term. So this is the kinetic energy held within the velocity dispersion of the stars in this system. And so again, we're going to just say it's another constant, A1, times the velocity dispersion in the system. And what's going to happen, which I'll describe a little bit more, we're going to say that the spirals are completely circular velocity dominated, so they contribute directly to this term. The ellipticals or spheroidal systems are completely dominated by the pressure term, so they will contribute here. And then the potential energy term is just gm over r summed over pairs, and again, we're going to simplify that by putting an unknown constant to be determined, and then gm over some characteristic radius, which will be the half-light radius. So all that, it has to be true given those constants, and the magic will be in what those constants are. So here I've just replaced this by the various terms that I told you about. Now we have to do a little bit more work because, in fact, I don't have the mass of the galaxy. I don't know the mass of the galaxy. And I want to understand a little bit better what's going on here with the kinematic terms. So I'm going to make a simplification here that is the first real sort of questionable simplification. I'm going to say that I can relate that in a given potential, if stars are rotating or if stars have velocity dispersion, that is, if the galaxy is either pressure supported or rotationally supported, I can somehow relate those two. And what I'm doing here is I'm saying that I'm going to take the approximation that we're working in an isothermal sphere with anisotropic velocity dispersions. If that's true, then the circular velocity squared over 2 in a system that's completely rotational supported would be the same as sigma squared in that same potential if the galaxy is pressure supported. So these two can be then compared directly. And I'm just going to relabel this kinematic term v squared. So you'll see v squared for the velocities. For a spiral, I'll just put in the circular velocity squared here and make sigma 0. For an elliptical, I'll put the velocity dispersion in for sigma and leave vc to be 0. And then I've just put the constant out there. For the mass, how we get the mass, we're just going to say it's the light, so pi r squared surface brightness within Re, times the mass to light ratio. So this epsilon, when you see epsilons in the equation, it's going to be mass to light. All right? And then over Re, which I've left in there. So if you take this and you take the log of both sides, you get this. Log Re equals log V squared minus log IE minus log mass to light ratio plus some other terms, which are these coefficients that I've left out here. So this is starting to look like the fundamental plane, except in the fundamental plane, you have funny coefficients out here. The reason you have funny coefficients out here is because people have ignored this and fitted all of this behavior empirically. So if you ignore this and you fit to the data, you find that you can, you know, you'll fit and you get some coefficients here. And how people have interpreted those coefficients is by something called homology. So if, for example, the mass to light ratio was linearly dependent on the velocity, let's say, then you would get another log V term here. And so you would have, you know, 2 log V minus log V. You put those together and you'd just be left with 1 log V. If this had some other dependence on V, you know, V to the 0.8, then you'd be minus 0.8 log V and you would get 1.2 log V here. Okay. So the interpretation of why the fundamental plane works at all is that, in fact, you have these relationships between mass to light, or the structural terms, that are directly related to V and IE. Okay, that's why people think the fundamental plane works. On the other hand, it didn't have to be that way. These terms could depend on something completely different. Could have depended on the merger history, right? The mass to light ratio or the structural terms. Could have depended on something unrelated to V or IE. And the degree to which they don't is reflected in the little scatter that there is in the fundamental plane. All right. So, but I'm going to take a slightly different approach than what's been done in the fundamental plane. I'm going to put all our ignorance, because this encompasses all the stuff we don't know, mass to light, structural term. I'm going to lump all of that into something I'll call delta for now, and see whether, in fact, when you put all sorts of galaxies, you see some structure, some pattern in delta. That's going to be the argument for now, and see what happens. I don't want to mess with this part, because this is straight from the virial theorem. So putting in funny coefficients here just confuses the situation. So let's leave this as it is, and then look and see what we can do with the delta part of it. So I've glommed onto whatever data I could find, the full range of different types of galaxies. And you can see, just from the nature of these samples, that people haven't really worked to unify these. So these either have just ellipticals, just dwarf ellipticals, just disks, and so forth. And so we sort of had to mix all of them together, which can lead to some scatter because they're done in slightly different ways and all that, but we'll leave it as it is. All right. So let's take a look and see what delta looks like. If I just solve that equation for delta for each of these galaxies. So let's look at the top here. This is the data. These two panels are the data. Where it's log V here and log IE here versus delta. So you look at this and you say, well, maybe there's some pattern. For example, there's some relationship in delta with IE. But there's an awful lot of scatter here. For example, this is log. These are all log terms. So this is, a factor of 10 in scatter here. And so you say, well, perhaps there really isn't some underlying pattern, or at least there's a lot of scatter that would sort of quash any attempt to put this all together. In fact, though, this turns out to be a surface that's curved in this 3 space. So what we're showing here are projections, but in fact, this scatter is due to the fact that you're seeing a distribution that fans up along the surface. And you can fit that surface, and if you look at where the points lie on this surface now with zero scatter, this is the projections you would see. So if you fit the surface out, and then you ask for the given V and IE, where does the point lie on the surface, then you would see these projections. And I'll show you a little movie in a second. So in fact, most of the pattern you see, the smearing here, these trends up, are just due to this funny surface you're looking at in projection. So delta, which had mass to light ratio, which had these structural terms, is well defined by a surface in V and I, by V and IE, basically. So that's what this is.
Scatter around the surface?
So I'll get to it in the projected plane, but it's like fundamental plane, so it's a 0.08, 0.09 in RMS in the log. So here is just the data which you're seeing spin around, and then you'll see the fit, with the same distribution in V and IE to show you what the surface looks like in more detail, and you'll see that there is scatter, but you'll get a better idea of the shape. So it's sort of a little bit of a bowl. Those were the dwarf spheroidals. So these are the galactic dwarf spheroidals. This is where the bulk of ellipticals and spirals lie. And these are more massive things like brightest cluster galaxies.
And the classical fundamental plane would just be a plane fit to one subset of this.
That's right. So in projection, in those plots, it would have been a straight line in both of those projections. So this is now what it looks like if you plot the equivalent of a fundamental plane. It's now sort of a fundamental manifold. But it's log RE here 2 log V, log IE, and delta, where delta now comes from this fitted surface. So if I evaluate delta for each galaxy using V and IE, I can then put a galaxy on this plot. And so this is the full range of objects going from dwarf spheroidals all the way up to brightest cluster galaxies. Here you see where the ellipticals lie. These are dwarf spheroidals in, actually, sorry, I misspoke before. I'll show you what these are. So these are the dwarf spheroidals in R around the Milky Way. And you see, in fact, some points down here at sort of similar RE that are not dwarf spheroidals. One of these is M32. So M32 and the dwarf spheroidals lie pretty much the same place on this projection. They obviously have different Vs and IEs, but in this projection they lie about the same place.
How many different deltas do you have? Or is it one delta for all the galaxies?
Delta is a function of V and IE. Yes.
So that whole surface that we were
that whole surface.
So there's only one delta for each combination of
V and IE.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And we'll get to what delta actually is in a little bit. These are ultra-compact dwarf galaxies. So these are things that have been found in Fornax and so forth by Mieszki et al. And these are the disks. These are normal spiral galaxies. So everything lies on this projection if you use this fit for delta. So all types of galaxies satisfy this equation, and delta is a function primarily of V and IE. You don't need other information. So the entire sequence of galaxies really is a two-parameter sequence of V and IE. And so you know that there must be two fundamental parameters that drive this relationship. Just like for stars, you saw a one-dimensional sequence. Now we're seeing a two-dimensional sequence for the galaxies. And so there must be two basic parameters that drive it. It won't be V and IE. There will be some fundamental parameters. But basically, you're seeing that it's a two-dimensional sequence.
But isn't it odd that delta has this forked kind of bowl structure? I mean, so, you know, in principle, right, just the way these arguments go, you could have, you know, you would have actually a bowl or
yes.
something like that.
Yes.
So are you going to get to why?
A little bit, yes. Yes. Now, the bowl shape and the sort of two prongs are a little bit deceiving. If you really had complete samples of galaxies, one of those forks would be dominantly populated because it's the faint galaxy end. So, all right. So what's delta? That's really the question now. We've sort of lumped in all our ignorance into delta, but what is it? Can we make some progress on what delta actually is? So here is what delta was defined to be, a combination of these things. Let's see if we can just make delta the mass-to-light ratio. Let's see if we can somehow show that delta is in fact just log mass-to-light ratio and set these all to some constant.
Is that top equation what you were applying in the previous two slides?
Yes, so that delta was set to be, all this was lumped in as delta from the virial theorem derivation. So, let me go back here, just to be clear, make sure everyone gets it. Oh, too far. one more. So we have this derivation, and I just said that's going to be delta.
Right, you don't know all those things right now, so I'm being a bit slow.
That's right.
Those things right now, so in the following two slides, delta arrives from somewhere.
So I solved this equation. I know right, RE, V, and IE are observed, so I could solve for delta. Then what I did was I fit the surface.
It by definition is a straight line.
That's right. So I fit this.
And why they scatter around a straight line, sorry.
Yes. So I fit the surface with a function of V and IE.
Okay.
Just a polynomial, yeah, second order.
Okay.
And then that's what I take for delta for each galaxy. So the scatter you're seeing is the scatter between this fit and what this actually is for the galaxy. So it's sort of all the other things that were not included in a V and IE fit.
What is the justification for singling out RE out of these three quantities?
Partly historic, partly the reason it was done for fundamental plane work is that this is the distance-dependent quantity. These are distance-independent, so they were separated out. But yeah, you could pick any two and get the third. Too far here. Okay. All right. So let's get back to this plot. So for some galaxies, we actually have independent measurements of mass-to-light ratios. So for example, Capillari et al. Used the Soron data to do dynamical modeling of some elliptical galaxies using Schwarzschild modeling, for example. And so they're able to evaluate mass-to-light ratios using that method. Another sample from SLAX, Bolton et al. Used strong lensing to figure out mass-to-light ratios of those elliptical galaxies. And so there are samples of elliptical galaxies, at least, for which we have independently derived mass-to-light ratios. And that's what I've plotted here. And here I've put delta, okay, with the offset to make this a one-to-one relationship. So basically, I've taken log RE plus some constant here to get these to be on the one-to-one relationship. And so you see, in fact, that delta behaves very nicely like mass-to-light ratio. That is, it correlates with mass-to-light ratio quite well. So let me show you what these various samples are. Red are the capillary ellipticals where they saw no signs of strange kinematics, orbital anisotropy, models that didn't fit well, and so forth. So these are the most likely candidates for things that behave well in the structure sense. Then they saw, they had the other kind of ellipticals in which they saw kinematic oddities, and these are the open symbols. And so you can see that the scatter in the open red symbols is much more than the scatter in the closed and the filled red symbols. So this suggests that, in fact, you can't completely ignore the structural terms, but that, in fact, they don't bias the result. The open symbols sort of straddle this line as well. So they add scatter, but they don't change the relationship. Mass-to-light ratio is still the main driver of this. And then the blue are the SLAX data. Okay? So delta is primarily mass-to-light.
Are delta faint compacts on here?
No, there aren't independent mass-to-light ratios for those.
But you can fit delta for them and just say, you know.
Yes.
And you know, I mean, people have estimated it just from the, estimated the mass-to-light ratios for like Segway 1 and that kind of thing.
Yes, I'll get to the Dorff spheroidals in a little bit. Yes. Okay. So that curved surface we had was really a description of mass-to-light ratio as a function of V and IE. Andrew, do you have a question?
Yeah, so the mass-to-light ratio you put here is a stellar mass-to-light
ratio. This is total.
This is total.
Yeah.
Uncertainty on delta.
So the RMS, if you assigned all of the scatter in that linear relationship that I showed before to delta, you get about a tenth in log, which is, you know, so 20% in this sort of plot.
This is mass to light in the effective ratio.
Yes.
How's that related to half-life radius, remind me? Or is that half-life?
Sorry, yeah, it's the half-life. For our quarter, it's half-life radius. And for the spirals, we took the half-life radius. So, okay. You can add to this what's been done for the Dorff spheroidals. Those are the red points using velocity dispersions measured from Walker et al. They fit in FW profiles to the velocity dispersion profile. And so those lie there. There's more scattered because those are velocity dispersions are small and there are more uncertainties and so forth. But it falls, it continues on the relationship we saw. And if you take all those independently derived mass-to-light ratios and you put them in here, so delta now is changed to be log of the mass-to-light ratio minus a constant, then this is the relationship you get, again, spanning from Dorff spheroidals to massive ellipticals. So the argument would be that delta is in fact the mass-to-light ratio. And so if you have the mass-to-light ratio of an object, again, within RE, you can just put it on this. You don't have to use the fitting formula for delta. If you don't have the mass-to-light ratio, you can use the fitting formula for delta and put it on there. All right. So let me just move a little bit, tangentially for a second, just to show you why you need this sort of curved behavior in the mass to light ratio, and so why the fundamental plane can't work. So this is log V, and this is log mass to light ratio. So the fundamental plane, the reason the fundamental plane works over the range it does is because the mass to light ratio is or can be described as a function of V. And in fact, if you had a straight line here, then that would be a power law relationship between mass to light ratio and V, and you would have a fundamental plane. But in fact, for low Vs, independently derived mass to light ratios. These are from Jean's models of nearby galaxies, mostly for work on central black holes. People try to model what the mass is for the galaxies. So if this was a straight relationship, you would have a plane. But obviously, when you get to low values of the velocity, it sort of turns around. And the reason is that this is the mass to light ratio of a pure stellar population. So it can't continue. If you're talking about low luminosity or low velocity systems, you can't break through this point here, and it has to turn. And so that's why you can't extend the fundamental plane down to low luminosity ellipticals. It just won't work because you just physically can't do it. And that's why you get this bowl shape at the bottom of that curve. Now, it rises again, and we'll get to that as well, but why you get this turn is just because of the you know, you can't go below the just a purely stellar population. So let's take a look at a purely stellar population. We'll look at globular clusters. So right now what I've done is I'm showing you the same plot as before. I've taken out the ultra-compact dwarfs because they lie sort of in the same regime as globular clusters, so they sort of would confuse the issue here. So I've sort of cleared this region out. So when I show you the globular clusters, you're just seeing globular clusters. But the same thing on this y-axis.
Points of the cluster. I mean, you know, there is debate about the ultra-compact dwarfs.
Yes.
I mean, could this also be a discriminant of, you know,
yes,
galaxy formation versus other stuff?
Yes. Okay. And we can talk more about that. But let's see where the globular clusters lie on this. So here they are. I've taken a sample from McLaughlin and van der Marl, who've tabulated ages, metallicities, and they fit stellar population models. So what I've done here is I've just taken their mass-to-light ratios from their stellar population models. So no dark matter, just what is the mass-to-light ratio of the stellar population that makes up that globular cluster. And I've put that in for the mass-to-light ratio. And you see, there's a very nice sequence, but it's offset. So why is it offset? Well, there are various reasons it could be offset. It could be offset because the structure is different. So those A and B terms would just be a little bit different. And so they may have shifted the whole thing. But let's take a closer look and see. So these are the globular clusters. Let's zoom in on those. And here they are again. So I'm now just zoomed in. And you see some globular clusters lie on top. And it doesn't really look like just uncertainties, right? They don't scatter to both sides. There's a trend to scatter up in this plot. So a very tight sequence parallel to the sequence that we have, but offset. So we can plot their mass to light ratio. So we can plot this difference from the line to the globular cluster versus age. And here's what we get. So we see the young clusters fall right on the relationship. There's no difference between the extension of this line and where they lie. And so this would argue that the IMF is fine. That if you, for young clusters, the mass to light ratio they get does get you to the step where you, to get the mass to put those objects on the relationship. And now what's happening is as you go older, to older and older clusters, this histogram is just showing you the distribution here of the oldest clusters. So you can see that they are sort of centered up here. This distribution just systematically diverges from where the extension of the line on the previous plot is. So it suggests that there's perhaps some problem with the evolutionary models, that their mass to light ratios for most of the clusters, which are here, are off, that is, shifted from the line, and that shift has to do something with the way the evolution is handled, because it's not that all clusters are off, it's only that the oldest ones are off.
So why couldn't that just be a dynamical?
It could be a dynamical effect. It could be that mass loss hasn't been done right. So that the clusters are low means that the mass to light ratios are overestimated. And so if somehow you lose more mass than you think, then that would bring it back up. So yes, but it could also be that the structure somehow is changing. Although you'd have to keep that, the parallelness of it means that you have to keep that behavior constant over different masses, because those clusters span different masses, different environments.
This way
in time. Yeah. Yeah. And different environments. Some of these are Magellanic Cloud clusters, some of them are Milky Way clusters.
Is there something special about these ones that overshoot? I mean, these ones that go below zero? Yeah.
These? That one I don't know. I'm just going to show you now for the oldest clusters what we see. And so we also see a variation with metallicity, although there's more scatter here. But there may be something funny about the models as a function of metallicity as well. So we've just started playing with this, but it might be an interesting way to go back and test stellar evolution, you know, Bourgeois-Charlot and Pegasus-type modeling, to see whether there's some systematic problem there. All right, so that was for globular clusters. Let me now talk a little bit about dwarf spheroidal. So what I've done here is I've plotted globular clusters. This is a slightly different sample of globular clusters, but the open symbols are Milky Way globular clusters. And what I've plotted is the velocity dispersion you'd infer for the system if you just forced it onto this fundamental manifold relationship. So if you know RE, IE, and the mass-to-light ratio, which is just the stellar mass-to-light ratio, you can solve for the velocity dispersion that the system must have. And here is the observed velocity dispersion. Okay, so you can see the globular clusters follow nicely, one-to-one relationship between the predicted velocity dispersion and the observed velocity dispersion. The filled symbols are all the dwarf spheroidals in the Milky Way. So everything that's had a velocity measured up to about a year ago, and I'll talk about some newer systems in a second. Okay, so large errors, because they're always, these are low velocity dispersions, hard to measure and so forth, but they also tend to follow the trend. Okay, now there are three new, relatively new ones, Bode's 2, Segway 1, and Willman 1, which we would predict, if we just forced them onto the relationship, to fall here, here, and here, so down in here, in this relationship. And in fact, since we made this plot, a couple of them have had velocity dispersions measured, and they're right here. So these two, maybe slightly above the where you'd expect them, but no more than 1.5 sigma off. And there are reasons why the observed velocity dispersion might be biased upwards for these very low velocity dispersion systems. So the dwarf spheroidal seem to lie on this fundamental manifold just as well as everything else. There seems to be no increase in scatter beyond the observational scatter, no systematic departure from the relationship. So where are we? So the virial theorem plus some understanding of the mass-to-light ratio. For stellar-dominant systems, you can just use the stellar mass-to-light ratio. For dark matter-dominant systems, you can use this fit that we've provided as a function of V and IE. Those describe the gross structure of all these galaxies to within 20% or so. So if you want to know the velocity dispersion and you have all the other things, or if you want to know the mass-to-light ratio and you have all the other things, you'll get to within about 20% RMS by using these relationships. So the scatter constrains any other model that you want to put in there. So if you are a favorite of winds or ram pressure stripping or whatever physical model you're trying to model, you can't mess things up by more than about 20%. So if your model has these galaxies, a particular galaxy losing 3/4 of its mass early on, it just won't work if its structure is not somehow compensating for that mass loss. So if all you say is, I'll just have 3/4 less light in this galaxy, but its structure stays the same, it won't lie on this relationship. Yeah?
The mass-to-light ratio is a product of the physical processes as well, though, right?
This, yes.
Yeah, very much so.
That's right. That's right. All right. So let's see if we can make some progress and try and understand the two parameters that drive the mass-to-light ratio. Because now I've just sort of moved our ignorance on to what drives the mass-to-light ratio, what physical processes drive the mass-to-light ratio. And so we get back to the points I started with, which is that we want to know the efficiency with which baryons are turned into stars. So what fraction of all baryons become stars in this halo? And how concentrated are those stars in the dark matter halo? And so I'll define eta to be the sufficiency and c to be the ratio of R200 over the half-light radius. And what you can do is you can, if you make one assumption that the velocity dispersion at large radii is the same as the velocity dispersion at small radii that you've measured, i.e. that you have isothermal, you know, galaxies, then you can rewrite the equations for the entire halo in a similar way as you wrote them for the inner, you know, part. And you can, so if you do that, and if you also say that all halos start with a universal baryon fraction, you can make the following plots, which is the efficiency. So because we know now, because we know the mass-to-light ratios for these galaxies, we can, say what fraction of baryons were turned into stars. And because we know the half-light radii, we can also say how far those things had to compactify. So for all the galaxies in our sample, we can do this. The red are the spheroidal systems. The blues are the disks. And so you see that the efficiency is, of order 10%-ish. For most systems, the efficiency drops like a rock for the dwarf spheroidals. There's a slight tilt, so the more massive galaxies are slightly less efficient. That is, they've turned a smaller fraction of their baryons into stars. And then for concentration, in fact, the dwarf spheroidals are no more or less concentrated than the bulk of the galaxies. But what you see is that the ellipticals are more concentrated than the disks. Okay, so. R200 over RE. So here actually the ways we actually calculate, but don't worry too much about that. Here is a plot showing a comparison of our efficiencies with efficiencies derived from weak lensing. So Mandelbaum et al. Have looked at Sloan galaxies, done weak lensing, gotten halo masses compared to the luminosity of the galaxies, and so they have an efficiency measurement. Their points are the red points. And they've binned lots of galaxies into each of these bins, and they see this pattern for the ellipticals, for the spheroidals, and this pattern for the disk galaxies. And in the little black dots are our data. So you see, in general, there's very good agreement in doing this the two ways. That is, the efficiency is roughly about 10% for your average elliptical galaxy.
Why is the scanner so much smaller than the parent error bars?
So the error bars are mean in the Mandelbaum data. They're means for large samples that they've gotten. The black points are our data, so they're unrelated to the red points and have other sources of error and stuff.
Maybe for the right one.
In the right one, I think they just have. So why are their error bars so big? Or
yeah, the error bars are so big, but their points are still pretty close together.
Yeah, I don't know. My suspicion is that they have few galaxies in the disk galaxy set of their sample, but I'm not sure.
They're fewer and they're less efficient, so it's more
difficult to measure. Yeah, maybe. But why they don't scatter more, given the errors? I don't know. All right. Okay. So where are we now? Well, we have scaling relations that can be used to populate halos. So those relationships now for a given halo can tell you what the efficiency is and how those baryons are concentrated. And so really what you want to do is you want to look at relative questions of efficiency and baryon packing. So for example, if you want to understand why dwarf spheroidals have such high mass-to-light ratios, you see from that type of plot that it's the efficiency and not the concentration that's driving the high mass-to-light ratios. And you can start providing absolute numbers. So for example, you can take all the Milky Way-like galaxies in our sample, average those together, and you get that the efficiency is about 14%. So you turn about 14% of the initial baryons in that halo into stars to get that type of galaxy. All right, so where do we need to go now? Well, we need to still work to get to the fundamental parameters that drive the mass-to-light ratio relationships. So efficiency and packing are nice, but something is driving that efficiency. Why does the efficiency vary from one galaxy to the other? Why do you see more or less packing in one type of galaxy relative to the other? Now, you'd like to think that somehow these are going to be related to mass and angular momentum of the halo. And so if you could track that down somehow, that would be the ultimate goal, to really see how the mass or the angular momentum is tied to that. We don't have that yet, But one way you might start looking into that is to look at the face-on distribution of galaxies in this manifold. We've looked at it edge-on, so we've looked at the scatter. If we can turn it around, look at the manifold, look how it's populated. So one thing that has not been done in any of these studies, including fundamental plane or anything, is really a fair sampling of that plane or surface and understanding the distribution of objects within that. If you could have that, then you could start comparing to halo models, for example, and you could start trying to understand why regions of the plane, well, if this region of the plane is heavily populated, it has to be a common type of halo. And we haven't done that yet, but that would be the place to go, I think.
So that'll be your horizontal branch and your white dwarf cooling sequence, effectively.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't want to take the analogy too far because it's not necessarily evolutionary, but yes.
That gets up to my point earlier.
Yes.
It's not that this is a bowl uniformly populated.
No, that's right. That's right.
It could have been.
That's right.
In fact, you've got the dwarfs, which are a big, strong thing. You've got the bottom of the bowl, and then you've got the big things, which are rare.
That's right. That's right. But if you really knew how that gets populated, then you could start making comparisons to try to extract this.
Right.
Yeah. All right, so let me just summarize now. First, all the galaxies, every kind of galaxy we've managed to find lies on this 2D surface, means that there is some underlying structure, something that drives structure for all types of galaxies, not just ellipticals, not just spirals, not just low luminosity, but you should be able to find one thing that explains how all of these galaxies are distributed in the space. And it's pretty simple. It's just virial theorem plus something that drives the mass-to-light ratio. And so all the galaxy formation physics is in this mass-to-light ratio term. That's what you really want to try to understand to understand how to populate this. So that's where we're going, and it looks to be related to the efficiency in the packing. We think we can tie that to the mass-to-light ratio. And then the next step is to understand what is driving this. Why do certain classes of galaxies behave so coherently in their star formation and their packing? For example, this sample contains galaxies from all sorts of environments. Clusters, field, Milky Way, satellites, and so forth. And yet the scatter is still the same as it is for fundamental plane studies of cluster galaxies or Tully Fisher samples in the field. So environment has not appeared to add a lot of scatter to this relationship. So, why is that the case, and why do these behave so consistently across all types of galaxies? That's where we want to go with this now, and we'll see where we go. Thanks.
So where are the globular clusters in terms of the efficiency and packing? I mean, you can tabulate, they don't have the same meaning as in the galaxy case, but I mean, you can tabulate these quantities for the globulars as well. Because the globulars, at least the young ones, also obey this 2D surface, basically.
So they don't obey the 2D surface. So there are two steps here. There's one where you're saying, virial theorem plus mass-to-light ratio versus RE, I know where the galaxy or cluster is.
Right.
But that mass-to-light ratio that you use for the clusters is very different than the mass-to-light ratio you use for everything else.
Of course.
So it doesn't. So if you try to use the bowl to predict what the mass-to-light ratio is for the globular clusters, you'd be way off. You would predict a dwarf spheroidal-like mass-to-light ratio, basically, because they're comparable size and velocity dispersion. A higher surface brightness, so that brings it down a little bit, but you'd still predict mass-to-light ratios of 10 instead of 2. So it doesn't really work.
So I thought that they were just offset by a little bit. I felt a little confused now. I thought that when once you put them in this delta space,
Yes. But the mass-to-light
ratio. That is the mass-to-light ratio. That's stellar mass-to-light.
That's just the stellar mass-to-light ratio taken from stellar models.
So if you predict delta from the surface, you get it too high.
Then they lie off.
Yeah.
So when we first put globular clusters on using that, it was a complete mess, and we just thought, well, globular clusters are different. And they are, but you can still put them on there if you know their mass-to-light ratio in some other way. Yeah.
On the other MassM, do groups and cluster of galaxies obey something similar?
Yes. So I've left them off to avoid confusing the issue, but we have intra-cluster light measurements for clusters and some high mass group things. If you take the clusters and you take their velocity dispersion, the galaxy-galaxy velocity dispersion, and you look at the intra-cluster light and you get an RE from that, then they lie on that extension. Yeah. Because it's virial theorem plus mass to light ratio, so it has to work in the sense, some sense, it has to be close. Yeah.
When you're talking about mass to light ratio, is it always stellar or sometimes total?
It's almost always total. So in all the plots, it's been total, other than for the globular clusters. Total within RE. So not total, but.
So,
yeah.
So for the dwarf galaxies, it's these giant mass light ratios.
That's right. So that's the ball, right? So yeah. If you look at the mass to light ratio, it's high for the big things, brightest cluster galaxies. It bottoms out for sort of 100 kilometer second velocity dispersion ellipticals, and then it comes back up for the dwarf spheroidals. So this decline is packing. Things just aren't packed in clusters very well. And this rise is efficiency. You get low efficiency in the very low mass systems. So it's dominated by both types of effects. Crystal.
So in this picture, I mean, the difference between a spiral and elliptical is one of packing.
Yeah.
I mean, they really span kind of the same range in star formation efficiency.
That's right.
Which, although it doesn't require it, I guess is consistent with making the stars that are in ellipticals and spirals and happen together somehow, for instance. It wouldn't require that. But.
Yeah, you'd have to, it's the old phase-space argument. You'd have trouble still concentrating them somehow, presumably due to dissipation that would come in that's not in this picture, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so I guess what I'm wondering is how does the packing work with that, with the old phase-space argument?
Well, I think, you'd have to appeal to the same out, that there's enough gas left in the ellipticals when they merge that they increase the central concentration.
So the tides are then through your packing process?
Yes.
Tides plus cooling.
Right. I think there are interesting possibilities to start looking at, more closely at environmental differences in the galaxies and things like that. Unfortunately, all of those, with these data, all of those are compromised because the data come from such different sources that there are, filter bands are different, people measured velocity dispersions a little bit differently over different regions and stuff. So you can't compare the spirals I got from one sample to the ellipticals from another sample. But it would be very nice to have one uniform sample across all morphological types and as wide a luminosity range as you can get. I think that would be nice, and then you could really look at this in detail. And then because you'd really want to attack that scatter. If you look at the globular clusters, they show very little scatter. So the scatter in the galaxies, as long as you can beat down your observational errors, might lead you to some physics, because that scatter might be physically driven as opposed to just observational error. And then you could start learning more. Right now, the scatter that's in that plot is dominated by observational errors, so I can't tell you what the intrinsic scatter is at all.
Yeah. Have you looked into putting these weird sort of redshift 2 things that are extraordinarily compact, very, very bright and massive, into this framework? I mean, where do they... you can imagine that, the things that are elliptical,
Yeah.
One in now, what's the big deal? But these really strange things that don't seem like they could get onto the fundamental plane by redshift 0. They're just too compact.
Yeah, I haven't. I haven't put those on there. That would be an interesting thing to look at and see. We've done, although we did it for the fundamental plane, but if you're talking mass and enough galaxies, that's comparable to this. We've done it for E+A galaxies to look if post-starburst galaxies could plausibly evolve onto the, the fundamental plane, and that seemed to work, even though they lie. If you just put them on there, they're off. The fundamental plane. You'd like to be able to do that here too. Yeah.
So does the outer part of a disk not matter? In the sense that, if you look locally between filled disk and disk galaxies in Virgo, right? Where you'd see the greatest differences in the star formation properties or anything would be at large radii. So things are straight and truncated.
Yeah.
In this picture, right?
Well, that's right. That's right. Well, this is...
The galaxy doesn't matter.
Right, but this has been something that's always bothered me about Tully Fisher, that it doesn't really, you could keep adding stuff, and the rotation curve's flat, to the degree it's flat, say that. And then, the galaxy could grow, and it's now more luminous. Why, that doesn't seem to work with Tully Fisher. Yeah. So one thing you could do with this that I'm thinking about trying is, we've done this for half-light radii, but this relationship will work at different radii. I mean, it should hold. It's the Virial theorem. And so you should be able to look at it at different radii and then look at the structural terms. If the structural terms stay constant, they'll all, at every radii, you'll still get them to lie on the same place. If, on the other hand, as you might expect, the structure changes, that is, the disk to halo contrast changes, and so those structural terms would change, you might start seeing deviations as you work in the same galaxy at different radii and you try to do this. So it might be an interesting diagnostic for how disk potential to halo potential is varying as you go out. And so I talked about out of disks at coffee, and so we have some data out at large radii that we may want to try with this. So we have rotation curves out to two optical radii from knots basically out there.
So this is really a question for Andrew and Gabriella. So to the extent that you do have, at least in Galform, you have radii for some of these galaxies, have you ever observed any kind of manifold like this because you do match Tully Fisher locally and luminosity from the principle.
We've never looked at this specific thing.
Right.
We'd be interested to do so, right? It's a trivial calculation.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what velocity range. If you're sort of going sort of L-star-ish galaxies, then fundamental plane will look just like this, and this will look just like fundamental plane. You won't see a difference. But if you're going to lower luminosity systems, then you may start seeing some discriminant.
Which is what I think would be very interesting.
Because there, you sort of, the nice thing about that is that you actually do have, I'm going to use the extended analogy, even though you don't like it. But you do have the right representation of your horizontal branch in your, in right. terms of the halos.
So in principle, you could predict the density distribution on the surface of that ball. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And do you just not, for those sort of intermediate mass halos, do you just, why don't you just have a continuous? That's really pretty weird.
Yeah. Well, and the scatter along there, if you see some, variation in scatter along it, it would be very interesting because that's something we could also get at.
Yeah, and I think that would be pretty fascinating, right? I mean, that's always one of the issues with the Tully Fisher and the fundamental plane is you put in these, very merger histories and all these other bits of physics, and all you do is thicken that up. And what you're showing here is a pretty limited scatter, so it'd be very interesting to see whether you can fit the models into that.
Right. Yeah.
Models do predict deviation from the Tully Fisher relation at low mass, which is connected to the mass to light ratio. So there's some consistency there. But.
Okay. Thanks.
So if you're interested in taking our